For the second year in a row, a terrible shooting in our country has made the sermon I planned for Father's Day inappropriate. Perhaps another year. Last year, it was a shooting of 9 African Americans in a church. And this year, it is the killing of 49 people, many of them gay or lesbian, in Orlando. So today, instead of Happy Father's Day on our church signs, we send the message to our community that gay lives matter and black lives matter. Last Sunday, not yet knowing the terrible details, I wrote a few words to acknowledge what had happened during our time in the service of meditation and prayer and read them. But at the end of our monthly Sunday potluck, I heard that the death toll was 50, 49 plus the killer himself. And like many people, I was shocked. I was stunned. My colleague, the Reverend Keith Crone, published some words on Facebook. Keith wrote what I was feeling. He said, "Today and forever, I grieve the loss of life. I grieve for the people who died in Orlando. I grieve for their families, their friends, and co-workers. I grieve for those who were there and feel both lucky and guilty that they survived while others died. We have witnessed another national tragedy. I grieve for all those directly and indirectly affected by today." Keith wrote, "I grieve for those who are reminded of their own losses, the parents and families in Newtown, Connecticut, in Columbine, Colorado, the church members of the congregations in Charleston, South Carolina, and the Unitarian Church in Knoxville, Tennessee, all those who know someone who has been lost in a mass shooting and feel the rise of emotion that a day like today produces for them. I grieve," Keith wrote, "for the police officers and safety officials who are trained in how to respond to mass shootings. I grieve for workers who must look at and remove the bodies, who try and keep the wounded alive, who must tell family members that someone they love has died or been hurt. I grieve for the reporters trying to tell a story while witnessing and listening to the horrible details. I grieve for the parents who must explain today to their children. And I pledge to be part of the solution, however many solutions it takes." Here in Sarasota on Monday, I gathered with many of you at Five Points Park. I estimate that at least 3,000 people were at the gathering. The planners asked one member of the clergy, of all the clergy in the Sarasota-Bradenton area, to speak, the Unitarian Universalist minister, the Reverend D. Graham. Dee is the consulting minister of the Manatee Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bradenton, and she is an endorsed community minister in our own church. I was proud that she was the representative of religious leaders at the event. It is especially appropriate because in her ministry, Reverend Graham feels a special mission to serve the lesbian, the gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer families in our area. We have, I believe, a video of Dee speaking.
To me, this gathering shows how much force of good, how much love there is in our community, not just in the LGBT community, not just in the faith community, not just in Sarasota or Bradenton or Manatee, but that really ultimately we can stand together and make a difference.
I was proud to see her represent us that day. This week I have read some news stories about the courage of individuals in Orlando and the police, the courage of the police and the hospital workers. These stories remind us that for every insane shooter, there are tens of millions of people who will fight back, who will take off their shirts to stop the flow of blood, who will carry the injured to the hospitals, who will line up to donate blood. And in their actions, they remind us of what is good. It is comforting for me to remember this. Now a week has passed, and this morning I am going to talk about politics. Some might say that politics of gun control, that is not the proper topic for a sermon in a religious community. Well, this is a misunderstanding of the history of religion. The founders of the great religions of the world were deeply involved in politics. Indeed, if I was able to bring Moses here today, he would say, "Have any of you not read the Sixth Commandment lately? It says, 'Thou shalt not murder.'" If Moses was here, he might point out that the massive number of guns in our country make it easy for people to murder. If I was able to bring Buddha here today, he might say, "The heart of my teaching is the transforming of suffering into peace and joy. Guns do not do this. Asking for more guns because you want to feel safer is like putting out a fire by pouring gasoline on it." If Muhammad was here today, he might point out that in most Islamic countries, most Muslim countries, there are very few guns. For example, 12% of all the world's Muslims live in Indonesia. In Indonesia, there is an average of half a gun for every 100 persons, one gun for every 200 persons. In contrast, in the Christian United States, there is an average of 112 guns per 100 persons. More guns than all of us, if we evenly divided them, we would have each have one and then have some left over. Unlike the United States, most Islamic countries have rational gun laws. Now, if Jesus was here today, if I was able to bring Jesus here to help me with the service, he might say, "Don't you remember I said, all who take up the sword will perish by the sword?" And what I meant by that is the more guns you have, the more people will die by gun violence. So if the role of religion is to provide us comfort and support in our grief, that is important. Yet in our own tradition especially, comfort and support is not enough. The role of religion is also to encourage us to engage in the world, to take action. 86% of Americans, including large majorities of both Republicans and Democrats, favor a law which would require universal background checks for all gun purchases in the United States using a centralized database across all 50 states. 86% of us agree on that. 71% of us agree to support banning gun sales to people on the federal no-fly watch list. This has now become known as no-fly, no-buy. If you can't fly on an airplane because you're on the watch list, you can't buy a gun. There's also substantial bipartisan support for gun laws preventing people with mental illnesses from purchasing guns. Yet these laws have so far failed to pass our House of Representatives and our Senate. Now, to win a political battle, it helps to know your enemy. And in this case, the enemy is the National Rifle Association, a wonderful organization that helped train people in the proper, safe use of weapons, was taken over by a group of radicals in 1977. And now they prevent us from having rational gun laws. According to those who have studied the NRA, when it comes to lobbying, they are very good at doing the very basic stuff that needs to be done in lobbying. The NRA staff knows that most interest groups rely too much on sending emails to Congress. They tell their 4 million supporters to write members of Congress. One NRA volunteer told his fellow members, "Thank you all for emailing your United States Senator, but you must also write and send a handwritten letter through the mail, because no one has ever tripped on a bag of email." Online advocacy, signing petitions on Facebook and sending emails, online advocacy is the lowest form of commitment, the most ineffective way to lobby Congress. In small gun clubs across the United States, close friendships have developed among NRA members. One of their longtime organizers said, "At the NRA, we believe in true grassroots. We don't think that volunteers are customers. These people are our friends. I've been in their homes. I've met their children. I've sat at their kitchen table. I've met their grandchildren. We on our staff do all the things we ask our volunteers to do. We walk neighborhoods. We pass out literature. We get on the phones. We raise money. We volunteer for political campaigns." Gun control organizations such as the Brady Campaign, the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, and the new one, Michael Blumenberg's Every Town for Gun Safety, these organizations simply do not have the grassroots networks that are as large as 4 million people who support the NRA. When it comes to face-to-face meetings with lawmakers, NRA volunteer lobbyists go into the meetings with their members of the legislature knowing more about current gun laws, knowing more about the constitutional arguments about gun laws than the legislators they are trying to persuade. They know their stuff. This is highly effective because lawmakers take less seriously persons who do not know the facts about legislation. Of course, gun control advocates counter with stories, horrible stories about children and others killed by gun violence. And these stories do have an impact. But the NRA has emotional stories also. One community wanted to limit the number of guns one could buy each month. So the NRA volunteer lobbyists went to the members of the city council in this case, and they told these lawmakers the story of a woman in the community who had purchased a gun to protect herself from her estranged husband, against whom she had obtained a restraining order. She was attacked by him, they said. Her gun malfunctioned, but she survived the attack. However, if the proposed law had been passed saying that she could only buy a gun once a month, she would not have been able to purchase another gun immediately because it fell within the restricted time frame. When the NRA tells stories about how they are looking out for the victims, they are effective in countering the stories of children who are killed by guns. The NRA focuses almost exclusively on gun control. Now, many of us who would like to ban assault rifles also have other concerns, such as climate change, income inequality, health care legislation. We pick our battles, and gun control does not always rise to the top. This is true for our political leaders also. Back in 2006, an element of the Democratic Party's strategy to win back the House of Representatives was to recruit Democratic candidates to run for Congress, Democratic candidates to run for Congress who supported gun rights. Then the 4 million members of the NRA, who are single-issue voters, would not organize against these candidates. Because NRA members are more likely to vote, more likely to attend campaign events, more likely to ring doorbells, more likely to make phone calls to help their favorite candidates. The hope was that more Democratic candidates who supported gun rights would be likely to get elected. And in 2006, the election resulted in a sweeping victory for the Democratic Party, which captured control of both the Senate and the House of Representatives. But as a result, 10 years ago, even when the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate, they did not have the votes for gun control. Now in the news, I read that the Senate is setting up a vote on Monday on several gun-related amendments to a spending bill that funds the Justice Department and other agencies. This vote was announced after Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy's nearly 15-hour filibuster on the Senate floor this week. These votes will be the chamber's first response to the massacre in Orlando, Florida. No fly, no buy is proposed by Dianne Feinstein of California. It would prevent people who have been on the terrorist watch list within the past 5 years from being able to purchase a gun. Democrats are also insisting on expanding background checks so would-be terrorists can't just bypass the system by going to a gun show. But look at the numbers. There are 55 Republican senators and 45 Democratic senators. Under the Senate rules, 60 affirmative votes, 60 are required to pass one of these amendments. So we need a lot of Republicans to support it. Well, we have a Republican senator, Florida Senator Mark Rubio. It is up to us, the citizens of Florida, to let our senators know how we would like them to vote. Given the short time, a phone call, an email to Senator Rubio's office is appropriate. However, this will not all be resolved on Monday. So writing a letter and sending it through the post office, something that senators can trip over, that is also helpful. And of course, voting in November for candidates who support reasonable gun control will be helpful. Nations do change in response to some tragedies. In November of 1990, a small New Zealand town, a man killed 13 people before the police shot him. The Conservative Party in New Zealand, the most conservative party, the National Party, was leading the country at that time. However, unlike our conservative political party in the United States, the conservatives in New Zealand acted. They conducted what they called a review of firearm controls in New Zealand. They considered a broad range of evidence. They examined international experiences with gun control. The result in 1992, 2 years later, was an amendment to the New Zealand Arms Act. Or consider the United Kingdom. In March of 1996, a local gun club member in Dublin, Scotland, killed 16 primary school children and their teacher and injured 15 others. John Major, Prime Minister and leader of the Conservative Party, introduced a Firearms Act of 1997. Not the Liberal Labor Party in the UK, but the Conservatives did this, the Firearms Act of 1997. Or consider Australia. In April of 1996, in Tasmania, a 28-year-old mentally ill man shot 72 people, killing 35 of them. Subsequently, the leader of the Conservative Party in Australia, Prime Minister John Howard, obtained an agreement from all 8 Australian states and territories to pass consistent legislation, including registration of all firearms and a prohibition on semi-automatic rifles and shotguns, except for those farmers who could prove a genuine need for such weapons. Now, what is striking to me in these examples is that it was the leadership of the Conservative political party in each of these countries that led to the effort to control guns. And perhaps someday the Conservatives in our country will follow the example of the Conservatives in New Zealand, in Australia, and the United Kingdom. Progress does occur, and it will occur in the United States. As I watched D. Graham speak on Monday evening, I remembered that when I was ordained into the Unitarian Universalist ministry in the 1970s, no Unitarian church had ever called an openly gay or lesbian person to serve as their minister. And there were, at that time, very few women ministers. Gay persons serving churches kept their sexual orientation secret from the congregation. When one openly gay young man applied to a church search committee in 1978, he got this letter from a member of the committee. I had intended to write you for some time to tell you my personal regrets regarding our committee's decision not to call you. The truth of the matter is that I do not think our membership could handle you. In my opinion, you would be a cause for concern among the membership who would find it difficult to understand, let alone accept your views. I wanted to send you this personal note because I think you are, far and away, the best of the lot. I have great personal concern that you get settled into the ministry. Well, this candidate did get settled into the ministry, and then he was appointed as the chair of our hymnal commission as responsible for our hymnal today. But in the 1970s, when I talked to Mark about this letter, he said, "It feels hopeless. It feels like this will never change." But it did change. And today, Unitarian Universalist churches no longer discriminate on the grounds of sexual orientation. And a year ago, the United States Supreme Court declared gay marriage legal in every state. Nations change. Democrats change. Republicans change. Even Unitarian Universalists change. It feels in 2016 like our country will never change our gun culture, but someday it will. Let's help it along. Let's give a gift on Father's Day to the fathers of those young people who died a week ago in Orlando. Let's make a phone call. Let's send an email. Let's write a letter to Senator Rubio. And let us continue such political action in the coming months and years.